sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The short squeeze continues. Another stellar unemployment report, and the Republican campaign goes off the rails. Our guest today, Matt Tucker from BlackRock. All this and much more on episode number 453 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, welcome. How are you? Andrew Horowitz here, and we are getting to March already, 2016. And we have seen markets do an incredible rally off of the lows and continuing in that very familiar V pattern that we've seen before. Time and time again, where things get oversold, they move up, panic selling, then panic buying. Seems to be all the rage these days. There is definitely a kind of an air of a short squeeze going on. You see that with many of the particular stocks in areas like materials, energy, somewhat biotechs, there has been an enormous move that has taken place. Just an absolutely stellar move that has gone on. And why is this? Well, for the most part, we've seen that the energy space, which had been leading markets lower along with financials, have seen some stabilization for whatever reason in oil. Even with the 10 million barrel build last week that we saw, oil seemed to rally, having one of the best runs you've seen in a while with oil. Maybe because there was so much bearishness in the markets and so many people were playing the short side of the equation, things got kind of overdone to the downside. Now, whether or not this is going to be a continuation pattern or if it is going to be just a move to get the S&P to certain levels, technical levels, as it did in fact move past the 1950 level this week, even though the beginning of the week started pretty rough. The employment report that came out showed that we are continuing in the U.S. to maintain our strength with employment at the backdrop of the rest of the world seemingly having major deflationary problems. But, you know, even with that, if you look at Europe and you look at many of the countries within Europe, even though there is some pockets of areas that have seen their employment situation really not get a lot better. But look at Germany, all-time low on unemployment rate. If you look at many of the major countries around the world, the unemployment rate is interestingly staying very, very low. Part of that could be that there has been no wage pressure. In the unemployment report we saw this week, there was no significant wage enhancement. That's allowing employers to simply go out and to hire people and not pay a lot more money for those particular workers. And that's kind of cool. If you think about that, because their overall expenses and their margins are not going to be squeezed too much by adding on people. Productivity has been very low, and that's because they're having a lot more people producing less, but yet at the same time, because we're not seeing this wage pressure, it's not really costing them a lot of money to do so. Now, on that, we've also seen that CPI, the inflation rate, is starting to tick a little bit higher, but nothing extraordinary. But if you look at the combination of inflation rate where we are currently and where the employment rate is currently at about 4.9%, we are really right on with what the Fed was looking for. So the whole jawboning of the markets that maybe they'll slow down their rate increases comes back into play in terms of maybe they're going to actually go out and start to rethink about raising rates at their March meeting. I think it's the March meeting that's coming up. It's a very possible situation right now. Now, what's really interesting to see is that many of the metals that had been running are continuing to do so. Gold and silver have been just on fire. Copper's been on fire, along with oil and other commodities. And that's helping a lot of companies with their run. You know, we've seen things like a Freeport MacMoran, even some of the energy companies. I mean, 20% a couple days in a row last week. Chesapeake Energy, SM Energy, many of the companies that were left for pretty much just dead have come back in a big way. They're still a long way from where they were. But with the stability of oil, banks have also participated in this rally. That's something good to see. I do wonder, though, if the fundamental underpinnings of what we are seeing in terms of the U.S. stocks is something that's going to hold, or if this is just a technical rally off of the bottoms that has snowballed into a major short squeeze that is going to be at an exhaustion point. As a matter of fact, after we talk with our guest this week, I'm going to discuss the key reversal indicator, the KRI indicator, that we look at and show you something very interesting that is going on right now. So overall, we're seeing that there's a lot of good things happening in markets right now. I still think there's a small amount of pessimism, or maybe a big amount of pessimism, and that's maybe what's driving this, the old whirl of worry that's driving markets right now. Over the weekend, we're going to see some commentary from China as to what they're going to do with their economy, their expectations for their GDP and growth out forward. And I think there's a lot of people don't want to get too, don't want to be short or really have too much of a position against that moving into the weekend. The currency there has been stable. We're seeing that Draghi has been jawboning all about the massive deflation. Pretty much the whole globe is still in a deflationary trend. And that's going to be something that we'll have to see how that plays out. But again, we've seen that some of the worst has become the best. The small caps are outperforming, materials outperforming, energy outperforming, biotechs are really doing well. Some of the bigger names like in the technology area, the NASDAQ 100, have not been participating as much. As a matter of fact, they had a pretty weak overall five-day period compared to the Russell 2000, compared to the S&P 500, compared to the Dow. Interesting to see that. So we're going to have to look at some of the other indicators to find out where we go. Now, right now, there may be a bit of a ceiling on some of the move here, even though there's a lot of optimism, there's a change of sentiment over the last few weeks, but maybe it's gotten a little bit skewed towards the bullishness. And again, we'll talk about that after we speak with our guest. What else do I want to talk about? I have some listener questions that came in. Of course, you could always send me your question at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I was also on Frank Curzio's show last week. We had a really good discussion. Talked about politics a little bit there, and I'm going to talk about that just in a moment because this whole Republican disaster of a campaign. Now, I'm not talking about whether I like the Republicans or the Democrats or whether I like Clinton or Sanders or Trump, or it has become a mockery of the system. You would have thought that when Trump won Super Tuesday overwhelmingly, that there would be some kind of a market reaction. We've looked at a lot of different sentiment indicators in terms of what could, quote unquote, could or should happen if Trump and Clinton won, if Trump and Sanders won, if Rubio and Sanders won, and all these different scenarios that come about. One of the things I found really interesting was that you do see that all of these players are targeting some similar areas. They're targeting the pharmaceuticals, targeting the banks. Some are targeting the Fed and the way that things go there. There is a lot of discussion about immigration, but yet there still is no plan that's been laid out. Really, I think probably, I guess the best, whether it's a good plan or not, is another discussion. But the most complete plan and direction has been laid out by Hillary Clinton in terms of really bashing the pharmaceuticals, and that we did see what happened there. Interesting to see that the pharmaceuticals have not really laid off and been under much more pressure considering what's going on there. I do think that there is going to potentially be some further kickback on areas that there is a discussion that has been developed by all the different candidates, particularly ones in the lead. So that's something to watch for, because they're going to continue to ramp up the rhetoric as they get stronger and stronger, as they see those things are the things that people are looking for. Because, of course, all of us want our healthcare prices to go down, because it's pretty backbreaking, the cost of healthcare for all of us. Pharmaceuticals and our pharmacy benefits, we want to make sure that we're not paying too much there, in various insurances, etc. So when we hear that, we have to look at how that's going to affect many of these companies. And while they were broken for a while there, they did see a tremendous amount of reprieve most recently. So that's something to keep an eye on. The other thing is that we do know that while we are seeing this massive short squeeze and oil stabilize in this general range between, let's call it 30 to 40, big range, but 30 to 40, you know, still we did see this big build last week. And even though we did see that the various OPEC ministers talked about a quote-unquote freeze on production, some of the things we talk about with Frank Curzio, as a matter of fact, on last week's show was the whole idea that many of these hedges are coming off. And while companies are actually going out and doing share offerings, very enormous share offerings, selling off assets, closing down various rigs, there still is a major problem. And we haven't seen, I think, the extent of the potential bankruptcies, whether it's going to be, you know, the whole oil sector and from top to bottom in terms of services, in terms of drillers, in terms of midstream, you know, give or take 15% default is what is anticipated. Whether that's going to be 7% or 20% really is not the big issue right now. We haven't seen a lot of that really play out yet. Right now, we're seeing the hopeful trade that things are just going to get better and the excitement that, hey, you know what? Maybe things are going to settle out. Anyway, let me get to a quick listener question that I thought was really good. And then we'll get to our guest because Matt Tucker from BlackRock is the head of iShares Fixed Income Strategy. And I thought that this question, which talked about mortgages and discussed fixed income, it was kind of a part of the whole thing, at least from an aspect of mortgage bonds and things of that nature. It was all the same topic, I thought, to a degree. So this is from Michael. And Michael writes in, thanks for taking the time to answer your listeners' questions. Great for me to do, or for you to do. We all appreciate it. So he says that my wife and I recently bought our first house. We got a great interest rate on the loan, 30-year fixed at 3.875. Many years ago, I would have thought that when I buy a house, I would make larger payments, try to pay it off quickly. However, now that I've gotten more into investing, my philosophy has changed. Why try to pay off a loan when I only pay 3.875%? On instead, I can invest my money and hopefully like earn maybe 10, 12% in a year on a stock, mutual fund, ETF, etc. Is this logical or is this just a great theory but not really how it works? And should I pay off my mortgage as quickly as I can? Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? The whole point of low interest rates is that you have less to pay. You can buy a bigger house, spend more money on it, helps the economy, and you'll have money left over. It's kind of the whole concept of what do I do with all my savings that I'm not spending on gas? So when costs come down and you have this locked in at 3.85, listen, I remember in many years ago when rates were, 15%, 12%, 10%. I mean, we're far away from that. Can you imagine having to pay 10% on your mortgage these days? Seems like, oh my God, how did anybody do that? But here we are with sub 4% interest rates for mortgages. And many people are actually saying, you know what? This is really cheap money. Why should I actually pay off my mortgage? I don't know what's going to happen with the housing values. I don't know what's going to happen with the overall economy. I don't know what's going to happen with the turn off that phone there. I don't know what's going to happen with the future of this. So might as well just pocket the difference and maybe invest it. This way I get diversification. And of course, you have to do so wisely. And I have now both things happening where I have my house being paid off, which will be paid off one day at a very low interest rate that I'm paying. And I have investments that I have growing, whether it's at 10%, 5%, or even 4%. 4% is still better than the current mortgage that you're paying now, Michael, right? It's, you're paying 3.875 and maybe even getting some kind of a deduction for part of that. So with that in mind, it's a very smart strategy, but doing it carefully, doing it thoughtfully, doing it in a way that is such an effect that you're going to be able to make sure that you don't wreck yourself by doing something too aggressively with this. This is, should not be the aggressive money that you're using. It should be long-term. It can match to the 30-year position that you have here. So it's a long-term investment plan. So that's good. And if you take that money and put it into an IRA or tax-deductible investment plan, think how much more money you just made because you get a tax deduction on the differential that you would have paid off on your house. So now you're really doing well. So I think this is a great question. I think it really answered a lot of something that many of you are thinking. And personally, I've done the same thing. I could have paid off my mortgage, but I got a 3.75. So why should I pay that off when my money is so cheap? And this, again, is what the Fed is trying to accomplish. They're trying to make sure that interest rates are really low and money is cheap so you can use it for other things And one of the things is to create the wealth effect and to create asset inflation. That's the whole trick about what they're trying to do. But again, you have to be careful with this. You can't be reckless. You can't all of a sudden take the excess money and go haywire with it, be really aggressive with it, and then have nothing to show for it at the end. So be diversified, whether it's a mutual fund, an ETF, and make sure that if you can, if it is tax deductible money that you can utilize, that's a very smart thing to do. If you have a question, you can just write to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And of course, you could follow me on Twitter. I put up that whole fiasco that happened with Ted Cruz where he had a little crumb on his lip and he exhaled it and then came back and he ate it. It was pretty hilarious. I taped that and I put it on Twitter, so you got to check that out. The Ted Cruz crumb incident from the debate the other night. That's Andrew Horowitz, one word, is my Twitter handle. Make sure to follow me there as well. Or you can go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you can find all the links to Facebook and Twitter and all the good things that are on there as well as our strategies, whether it's the Aero strategy, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth strategy, or our global allocation strategies. How about we get right to our next discussion? And our guest today, Matt Tucker with BlackRock. He is the head of iShares Fixed Income Strategy Team, and he and his team focus on product strategy for the iShares ETFs in North and Latin America. Over 15 years of experience in the fixed income markets and is a CFA charter holder. So Matt, welcome. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Andrew, for having me.
All right, great. Listen, so I had a lot of questions because we had actually a guest recently that it's kind of interesting, very controversial. His whole thesis was that mutual funds are a scam. And I'm not going to ask you to get into that discussion per se, but I thought it was really interesting that we're having now the other side, which is ETFs, to come back for this and talk about a few things. So I guess what I wanted to start off with, since you are in the fixed income area, maybe some of your take on the advantages and maybe disadvantages of bond ETFs versus mutual funds. And first, if you would, just set the stage real quickly of what is an ETF for those that may not have a real good working knowledge of it.
Yeah, sure. So if we think about, you know, the investment options available to investors, there's kind of three main ways that your average investor can invest in fixed income. So they can buy a mutual fund, they can buy an ETF, or they can even buy individual bonds, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about an ETF is in many ways like a mutual fund in that it's a diversified portfolio managed by an asset manager. So it's an actual PM who's running the fund. They're typically trying to match the performance of an index. They're rebalancing that portfolio to match some index or market performance. And so they're not trying to typically outperform or kind of look for the next great idea, but rather just give people exposure to a certain market. Like you can go and buy the high yield market or the broad investment grade market through an ETF.
Mm-hmm.
What makes an ETF different from a mutual fund? A couple things which are key. So one is most ETFs are index or passive funds, which is in contrast to most mutual funds, which are active. ETFs also trade intraday, you know, which is where they get a lot of the attention. And I think this is actually a really interesting advantage for people. So if you think about, let's say that today you want to find out what's happening in the municipal bond market.
Mm-hmm.
You really have no good indicator to say, well, what's happening in munis today? You know, what's going on in the market? It's hard to go and look at individual munis and see prices. There are now muni bond ETFs you can look at that actually show you intraday what's moving in that market. And you can actually trade and invest in those ETFs like a stock intraday.
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, an ETF, you can think of it as it's like a mutual fund and it's a managed product, but it's also like a stock and it actually lists and trades on an exchange and you can actually see it and transact in it throughout the day.
Is there problems with, have you found, I don't know if you've worked both sides, but is there sometimes problems with the fact that they're tradable daily throughout the day, intraday, with liquidity compared to, whereas a mutual fund only trades at 4 p.m. at the end of the day, right?
That's correct. What if it's a problem? And you think of it as just a different way that you can invest or transact. You know, so for most investors, you don't need to trade intraday, right? For most people, I wouldn't advocate that people, you know, churn their portfolio or be very active. You know, that's a very difficult thing to do to actually time the market. And generally, there are professional money managers who have some expertise in that, but that's hard for most people to do. But it is really important to control when you buy and when you sell, right? Like, so let's say you say that you're going to, you know, build a portfolio and you want to go, you know, invest in the bond market. To be able to look at the market and say, oh, I like where prices are right now, I'm going to make my entry into the market right now, that's really valuable as opposed to the traditional mutual fund construct, which is that, oh, I think I want to go in the market, I put my trade in now, but my trade doesn't actually get transacted until the end of the day at a closing NAV. So it gives the investor, the ETF gives the investor more control over their entry and exit out of a market.
Yeah. No, we like ETFs for a lot of good reasons. Obviously, you have to do your homework like in any other investment to make sure that there's liquidity, there's volume that trades, you know, what's really inside of it, because sometimes a label isn't identifying something exactly as they are. That's something that's never going to go away probably. But like you said, if it is an index, and what the interesting thing that you did mention was that if you wanted to know what's happening with a particular market, well, unless you have some very expensive gear like a Thomson Reuters terminal or Bloomberg or something like that, you really can't see the flavor of what's happening maybe in a specific area, whereas you can with an ETF because it oftentimes does track. So that's good information. Now, I wanted to kind of skip over to the whole idea of tips and treasuries. Now, you recently wrote an article about tips, why now may be the time for tips, which are treasury inflation protected securities. It has not been the time for tips for a while, right?
That's very true.
You know, I mean,
if you think about it, we just haven't had much inflation, right, in the market.
Right. Well, inflation by the traditional metrics of inflation, or I should say the official metrics of inflation.
Because, correct, yeah.
I mean, I talk to people all the time, and, you know, I get both sides of this discussion because I ask, you know, this is the man on the street discussion, you know, have you had an increase in your cost of living over time, you know, over the last several years when there has been, quote unquote, no inflation? And the answer invariably has been yes, but there is no inflation from the common sense of inflation when we look at what is reflected in the official numbers, as well as the fact that then that flows right back down to how tips perform. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because the whole idea of tips, which is the securities that will give you a safety measure like a treasury, but also some protection against, well, not protection, but well, like I said, I could say protection and opportunity if inflation does hit. But, you know, can you give me both sides? Because one of the things that's interesting is if there is inflation, you know, bond prices will possibly go down because yields will go up possibly. And that kind of is counter to the whole idea of a core treasury, right?
Yeah, I think when you think about tips and the opportunity, I think comparing them to a traditional, what I'll call, you know, nominal treasury is probably the easiest way to think about this. So if I hold a normal 10-year bond, or I hold a 10-year tip, my 10-year tip is going to pay a lower coupon. So I'm going to get less income every 6 months off that 10-year tip. Mm-hmm. But what that 10-year tip security gives me is that as inflation occurs and it's measured through the CPI, that actually changes the amount of face value, the par value of my bonds actually starts increasing along with inflation. And that has two effects, right? One, it means that my coupon dollar payment is going up because I'm getting the same coupon rate but on a higher amount of bonds. And it also means that at maturity, the bond is going to return more principal to me because more has grown with inflation. Now, the challenge you're thinking about, well, you know, which do I want to own, a nominal or a tip? It really depends upon what you think inflation is going to do. Like right now, if you look at a 10-year treasury security and a 10-year tip, the difference in their yield is about 1.6%. So the market's expecting inflation to be about 1.6% over the next 10 years. So if you think that's too modest, you think, wow, you know, we're bound to see things turn around, we're bound to see inflation come back into play, then you would prefer a tip security because you're going to get paid for that inflation as it accrues. And if you think, well, you know what, I'm actually not so sure about long-term growth, I actually think that it may actually be, you know, lower inflation than 1.6%, then you actually might prefer the 10-year kind of normal treasury security. So it kind of comes down to how you know, see the opportunity set and what you think about inflation. I'm sorry,
go ahead.
And just the last thing about it, which I think is just really important. I think what makes them so interesting as an investment is they're the only investment that pays you directly for inflation. You know, people look at real estate and gold and other commodities as ways to kind of play the inflation trade. But really, the only asset that actually pays you a cash flow for inflation is tips. And I think that's what makes them very unique and a very interesting potential add to a portfolio.
So how do... I have so many questions about this whole area because, I mean, there's things like you could possibly look to if there's going to be inflation. You could see, hey, maybe I'll do a paired trade with shorting a ETF that is a midterm or short-term treasury with short that and long the tip, right? That's an interesting idea, although you have to pay the dividend on it or the interest, right?
Correct.
So that's something that can give you a little bit of stability.
And you're paying, and the term that they use in fixed income markets is you're playing the break-even trade or the break-even or expected inflation. You're kind of making a bet on that, right?
Right, exactly. So shifting over to high yield for a second, this has obviously been something that I am certain that your team and you have been looking at very closely for some time now. Is that a correct statement?
Yes. I think it's a very fair statement.
An overwhelming what the hell going on a regular basis kind of situation. You know, where are we going to go? Is there going to be defaults? You know, what's going to happen here? It's interesting because there was two things that I looked at when I looked at high yield a number of years ago. And to be very honest with you, the whole oil play and what's going on right now never entered my mind, right? I mean, I don't think it entered anybody's mind. But the idea that high yield, which trades a little bit more like individual equities, or equities, I should say, in general, right? If you have a good equity market, high yield usually follows along because things are getting stronger and things are better. High yield has been, for what it is, obliterated over the last, I don't know, we'll call it a year or so. The question has been recently the concern with the blow up of Third Avenue Fund. I believe it's Third Avenue, right? Marty Whitman's fund, yes. Wasn't it Third Avenue High Yield?
That's correct.
Possibly some others out there, that there's a liquidity situation that has been growing due to the fact that many of the high yields have been becoming distressed in the oil and materials space. What's happening there? I know a lot of people talking about, wow, this is an opportunity of a lifetime right now. Are we looking at the potential for more defaults? Is this something that you are really focusing on?
Yeah, so let me go through a couple. There's actually a lot of great topics in there, but you don't mind, I'll kind of just walk through a couple of them because I think it's pretty interesting. So if we think first about just kind of the high yield market in the fall and the opportunity, you know, high yield really started getting hit when oil came off its peak, you know, in the middle of 2014. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a lot of the broad high yield indices and just kind of across the high yield market, there's probably about 15% of energy issuers in the high yield market. So a lot of these were, you know, refinery exploration companies who had a business that was very driven by the price of oil. And as oil really collapsed, you know, from $100 down into, you know, sub-30 at one point, those companies were hit really hard. And you definitely saw, you know, a lot of concern. You saw some defaults. You had at the same time a drop in like coal and other, you know, other commodities as well. And so things in kind of the energy and metals and mining sector all got hit to different degrees. That really had an impact on the high yield market. It definitely had a, you know, poor performance last year in 2015. And through the first probably 6 weeks of this year, it was selling off pretty strongly. But we saw actually was an interesting bounce around the middle of February. You know, if you look at so HYG is one of the big high yield ETFs out in the market, mm-hmm. and its price was trading in the, you know, the low 90s last year. It dipped down to 75 at the bottom. This was in the middle of February. And now it's rallied back up to 80. So you've seen a rally here in the last couple of weeks of almost 7%. And so you definitely have seen, I think, some increased confidence that maybe the worst has passed, that maybe people are overestimating the level of potential defaults and kind of cracks in the high yield market. If you think about that $75 price, that can equate, depending how you do the calculation, to a default rate of, you know, in the high teens. So I think people realize, well, you know what? We're running at high yield defaults right now of, say, you know, about 3 or 4%. We're probably not going to get to 16 or 18%. So maybe that price was too low and maybe defaults aren't quite that bad. So we're definitely seeing a rebound. We're seeing a lot of money coming into high yield ETFs and mutual funds over the last couple of weeks. And so it's been a real reversal from the first part of the year. So I think that you kind of confidence has come back into the high yield market. And you've seen some folks come in and kind of look at the opportunity and say, you know what, I actually think there's some value here. So I do think this will be a very interesting story to watch. As you point out, high yield trades a lot more like an equity. You know, if a high yield company, you know, these are companies that are more at risk for default. And so that risk is that the debt is at more at risk of not paying off par. And so it tends to be more volatile and move more with the broader kind of risk markets like equities.
The other question, let me just mention something and break in here for a second, because please. I think that The question of liquidity, obviously HYG and a few of these other ones are very large, very well diversified. But here's a question. So you have a situation where you have these bonds that are distressed. You don't want to sell them because the liquidity on those are lousy, and trying to get any kind of bid. And there was a point, I think, there was bids and asks were pulled, or they were pretty much non-existent, right? It was kind of like just give us an offer. There's actually a phrase in the fixed income market. When it's kind of like, okay, show me what you want to pay and kind of thing versus actual bid and ask. What was that? Do you know what that's called?
Like offer not bid or something?
It's an offer not bid. It's kind of like, so there was a time when that was there, right? You know, for a little while. The question is, if you have a liquidity issue where you're getting, and maybe even to mutual funds, and maybe this would happen with Third Avenue, where you're getting redemptions, but you don't want to sell certain things where you sell others. Is there a knock-on effect to other areas because of this potentially?
So this is actually a great topic, because there's been a lot that's been written and talked about just fixed income liquidity generally, but a lot of it's been centered around the high yield market. So maybe I'll touch on Third Avenue first, because I think that's just an interesting case study to kind of talk about. So Third Avenue is a case for folks who are not familiar. It was a mutual fund. I think it hit its peak in assets somewhere in the middle of 2014. It had some hard times in performance. It had a lot of exposure to energy names. And when the performance turned, a lot of the money started coming out. Now, that was a fund that, you know, we think was pretty unique in the market, and that it ran a very risky strategy relative to other high-yield funds, whether they are mutual funds or ETFs. So it had a lot more distressed names and names that had less liquidity. And so what happened is you had all this money coming out of the fund, and the managers reached a point where they said, you know what, we've got to close the fund, mm-hmm. because we simply don't think that we can continue to meet the redemptions coming out. I do think that was a somewhat isolated case. It kind of goes to show what can happen when you're running a high-yield fund with a lot of distressed names, and you have withdrawals, and you have trouble raising cash. And this is kind of a case study there, but it's important to note that, you know, this took place in the first part of December. And if you look at December, when there were a lot of outflows in the first half of December out of high-yield ETFs and mutual funds, you didn't have any stresses in other funds. So in some ways, Third Avenue is an interesting case study, but it represents a really extreme case, which probably you can't really apply to other high-yield vehicles in the market.
Yeah.
That said, liquidity is something that, you know, people focus on a lot. One thing that makes an ETF really different than a mutual fund, and I don't want to get deep into the mechanics here, but kind of the bottom line is that if money is coming out of a mutual fund, the manager has to sell bonds for cash.
Right.
They're going to meet redemptions, bonds for cash. If money is coming out of an ETF, the mechanism by which that money comes out is the ETF manager actually delivers bonds out to the market, and those bonds are then sold for cash out in the market. And what makes that really important is that it means that the fund manager, the ETF fund manager, is not on the hook for actually selling bonds and raising cash. Mm-hmm. And so it kind of protects the fund from that run risk and from that risk of not being able to sell securities in illiquid markets, which I think is important. The other thing about ETFs, which is also interesting, is because they trade intraday, when we have these periods of volatility and stress, they tend to trade a lot more. And so you see a lot of folks, yes, selling their high-yield ETF shares, but a lot of folks stepping in buy as well. You know, if we look at kind of the epicenter of that December period when we had Third Avenue and concerns about high-yield liquidity and flows, you know, flying around, people trying to trade exposure, we had a day where there was $4.3 billion traded in that HYG high-yield ETF. Hmm. You know, so one fund on exchange. It was actually one of the top five traded equities of the day.
Wow.
The whole equity market. So I think it really just goes to show the ETFs, yes, folks use it as a core holding. Yes, they use it as a way to, you know, kind of get into the high yield market, but they also just use it as a way to just adjust how much high yield they are. I would like more now because prices are down, or I'm concerned about where the market's going and I want less. And it's really becoming that instrument that helps people just manage their high yield exposure.
So as it's trading throughout the day, and on that particular day you're talking about with all of the trading that mm-hmm. goes on, when do you as managers and your team actually have to deliver and buy and deliver and buy, or is it just set time at the day, at the end of the day?
Yeah, it actually happens once at the end of the day.
Hmm.
So you can imagine during the day, you know, people are buying and selling shares, the ETF, and you've got brokers who are then, you know, getting long shares or getting short shares. It's only a broker-dealer who could actually do this transaction with the fund to either create new shares or to redeem shares they have. And so throughout the day, these brokers are basically managing their book and liquidity, and they get to the end of the day and say, okay, everyone was selling HYG, so I have a bunch of shares. I'm going to redeem those, which basically means they deliver those shares to the fund, and the fund gives them bonds. Or it could be a day where folks are buying high yield, and the dealer gets to the end of the day and says, you know what, I'm actually short a bunch of shares, so I'm going to go and buy bonds in the market, deliver those in, and create new shares of HYG. Hmm. So that process happens once per day, and you can think of it as kind of a clearing mechanism to kind of clear out any imbalances between supply and demand that have accumulated throughout the trading day.
Right. Now, let's talk about Latin America in the same discussion of ETFs, and obviously they're, you know, talking about down the list of liquidity and, you know, potential. Obviously, because it's an ETF, you, as you mentioned, you have to do your best to index according to a particular methodology. But let's talk about Latin America for a second. How difficult is it when you have countries that are serial defaulters, and you have currency swings that are out of control, inflation that's crazy, governments that are, well, let's just say not as transparent as other ones around the world. I mean, Latin America is kind of the epitome of lack of transparency in some places, right?
Yeah, it's a great point. You know, you can have some of these markets, as, you know, outside the U.S. that are not as visible. So we talk about, you know, the U.S. market not being that visible or transparent. It pales in comparison to some of these other markets out there.
Right.
So there are some funds out there. There are funds that invest in both U.S. dollar-denominated emerging market debt, including Latin America, and other funds that actually invest in local emerging market debt. It's actually the debt that's listed locally in some of these countries. A couple things I'll say about that. The funds themselves tend to be pretty diversified in terms of their exposure. So you're not going to find a country that, or a fund that just invests in Venezuela, for example, or Argentina, which are some of these areas that have had some stress. But you will find funds that invest across the emerging markets, which is going to include those countries. So one is you do have some diversification, which helps shelter the fund from some of these individual country shocks that come through. But that said, you know, if you look at performance, you know, last year it was a horrible year for emerging markets, you know, both in terms of, you know, just the movement in prices and, you know, in spreads in those markets, but also the exchange rates. You know, if you had local EM debt last year, given the strength of the dollar, you took a real hit just on the currency move, even away from whatever was happening with those local markets. So, you know, so EM is a, you know, is an asset class that it probably is not at the core of your portfolio for the average investor. I think you can make the case to have a little bit in your portfolio as a diversifier over the long term. But people should think about it as, yeah, it's a higher risk part of the market. You get paid more yield for that, but you are taking on risk to get that yield. And so you just got to be cautious and really thoughtful about how you put that into a portfolio.
Right. EM, emerging markets is what he's saying about that. All right. And let me,
I'm sorry, EM is emerging markets.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. This is as a fixed income guy. I don't know if you like to, you know, show up at a party. I'm like, hey, I'm a fixed income guy. But, you know, equity guys seem to probably get all the glory, it seems. But fixed income, we do. By the way, just for everybody's knowledge about that, about this issue, one of the things that is well known in the industry is that credit or fixed income usually smells the rat first. In other words, what I mean by that, and you can tell me what you think about this, Matt, but when you look at the markets of particular areas or maybe even of a company, it seems that the fixed income and the credit guys are always ahead of really what's going on, and the equities will follow sometime later on. And I don't know if that's because of the amount of research that goes into understanding the debt and the capital structure of a company when you're dealing with these companies or whatever it is. But we always say that debt is a much smarter instrument to look at than it is to look at the equity. I'm sure you'd probably agree with that.
You know, yeah, I mean, as a bond guy, I got to agree, actually. In fact, I've tried to announce myself as a bond guy or a fixed income guy at parties. It doesn't play well, so I've stopped doing that. But
oh, there's the bond guy. He's boring. Don't go over here. There's a bond guy over there.
Exactly. No, you can strike him away. But if you think about this, you know, it is the case that a lot of times you will see some distress happening first in the bond market, and it spreads to the equity market. This past, you know, 6 months is actually a great example. We saw real stress begin to develop in high yield last year, and you were seeing spreads or the amount of risk you're being, or basically the price of the risk you're being paid in high yield increasing. So people are saying there's more risk in high yield, but the S&P was kind of chopping along and wasn't really responding. And so U.S. equities and the high yield market were out of sync. And there was a lot of discussion about which one was right. And it turns out that, well, the bond market was right in this case.
Bond market's always right.
Pretty strong equity correction. So is it every time? No, but I think it's something that, you know, we keep an eye on to try to look for times when you're hearing something different from the two markets. And it makes you think pretty hard about, you know, which one is actually giving you the right indicator about what's going to happen next.
Yeah, finish up on something that I have been kvetching about, and I've been scratching my head. I have been just absolutely, I'll say confused, but also in a way horrified. Negative deposit rates. This must be throwing you guys for a tizzy, because this whole thing is so untested, so un. The whole idea, first of all, we know that Japan, when they instituted it, which Kuroda said they weren't going to do, and then a week later said, okay, here, we're going to do this, by the way. And markets responded really favorably for a moment, and then things got out of hand. This negative interest rate project, experiment, what's your take on this?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that I think the central banks view as being helpful for stimulating the economy. And I think the basic idea is that if lower rates are better, negative rates are even better than that, you know. But I think the reality is there's some really negative consequences, no pun intended, to negative rates, right? So the first thing you do is you really harm the saver. So you or I, if we're going to go to the bank and there's negative interest rates, I mean, we're just not going to put our money in the bank, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're going to take it out of the bank. You're going to put it under your mattress. At least it's going to hold its value. It's not going to fall in value. And I think that starts to create some real complications for banks and their ability to lend money, right? If you're not putting your money in there for your savings account, well, they may not be able to give you any money for your mortgage.
Right.
You know, so it starts having some real repercussions in the financial system. And the other part about it is that it seems like negative interest rates are contagious in the sense that if you look at Japan, right? So what they start? They started with the government saying, the BOJ said, on a very small part of bank deposits, we're going to pay negative interest rates. And we now have negative interest rates all the way out to 10-year maturity JGBs, right? 10-year maturity Japanese government bonds. And the reason for that is that once you create negative interest rates at the very short end, people in that market just pile out. They say, oh, well, I can't invest in, say, an overnight vehicle because it's, you know, going to get negative rates.
Right.
I'm going to buy a one-month or one-year vehicle that pays me a little bit of interest. That drives up the price of those one-year instruments, drives down their yield. They become negative. Then people roll out to the two-year or the three-year. And it basically has this almost contagion effect of pushing rates negative out the curve. And you've seen it happen in Japan. You're seeing it happen in, you know, even in like Germany. It's negative out past 5 years now. So I think there's some very negative consequences, and I think it's going to be a hard trap to escape because I'm not quite sure how.
Yeah, how do they get out of it? How do they get out of it?
Stimulus, out of it.
Yeah, would you agree that there's one thing about, okay, we have stimulus, we have quantitative easing, and all the things that go along with that by bringing down the rates on bonds, and if we do just even a quarter point increase, see how it kind of disrupts the entire environment, right? When you go from a negative rate to a neutral, zero, you know, not negative, boy, that snapback could be pretty ugly.
And it's untested, right? And that's really the challenge, is that no one really knows how this is going to end. I suspect that if we look back at this, you know, 10 years, 20 years down the road, people are going to realize that, you know, low rates provide stimulus, but when you cross into negative rates, there's actually some negative consequences that might actually outweigh the benefits.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be discovered, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's a conclusion we realize we came to down the road.
Yeah, they scare me only because, you know, again, it seems like, I'll just point this out, you don't have to agree or disagree, but central banks have become so enamored with themselves, believing that they can do all this through their, quote, by the way, the communication strategy, which is just simply saying whatever they want to say, it seems, to try to jawbone. You know, that's the community. When Bernanke came out, remember when he came out with a communication strategy? Oh, we're going to have a communication strategy. I'm like, oh gosh, what is that? That's going to be terrible. Now, I mean, I'd rather be, let me be a little bit in the dark. I don't want to know everything that's going on. And don't tell me this because all you're going to do is jawbone. And we know that you don't jawbone to the negative side. I mean, how often do you hear a central banker say, you know, things are really crappy out there? And yeah, I mean, it's rare. It's rare, you know?
It's rare. And the challenge we have with this communication plan in the current state is that you hear from every Fed governor,
right?
So you actually are hearing the debate that's happening inside the Fed. You're hearing it aired publicly. And I think for a lot of people that can be very disconcerting because they do hear this very wide range of views from a lot of people who sit on the Fed and who are voting members of the Fed. And I think it leads people to the wrong conclusion about what the Fed as a body is going to decide.
Yeah.
So in some ways, it's like watching the argument at the table, right? Like you kind of want to know what the answer is at the end, but if you watch the process, it may look a lot more messy.
Well, the process is very clear. It's whatever Yellen wants to do are the voting members, what they say, and the non-voting members say the other thing to kind of balance it out. That's the way it seems to me, at least. You know, non-voting is always like, well, you know what? We're not going to raise rates, or we are, you know, and this and that. And the voting guys are always saying what Yellen's thinking. Anyway, Matt Tucker from BlackRock. You'll find more information on BlackRock and the information on what we talked about on this show on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, the show notes for this particular show. Matt, I'll hang out with you at the party next time, okay?
I appreciate it. Thanks,
right. Hey, thanks, Matt. Bye-bye. Well, I thought that was a good discussion. And tips. I think tips are an interesting place to be. I think it's an interesting place to look at for your portfolio. While we don't have really inflation at this point that's at all rampant by traditional or even official numbers, so the CPI is pretty flat, and we have a deflationary environment around the world, I think that it's very interesting to see how this could be an interesting place. So just keep that on the sideline, you know, kind of keep that in the background and know that you have a lot more information about tips right now. You understand it a little bit more, and there's a lot more that, you know, you can take a look at that for the future. I mentioned at the top of the show this whole idea of this KRI indicator or the key reversal indicator, something that we track and keep an eye on because this gives us a really good insight into potential turning points for markets. We don't always see very extreme levels, or very rare, as a matter of fact, where you see either a significant oversold reading. And when we created this indicator, it is a variety of different sentiment and overbought, over, well, basically what we're doing is we're looking for put call ratio, we're looking for things like the Spearman, we're looking for advanced decliners and kind of consistency of that, and a few other things that go into this that can give us a real good inside look at what is actually happening with sentiment and levels that may be buyable bottoms or sellable tops. Now, a couple things to note. First of all, I think it's really important to recognize that buyable bottoms are a much better overall indication. You see them much more often because people usually would be more inclined to buy than sell. You know, there are more long position holders out there. The average investor is more of, hey, I'm going to buy if something drops. I like the stock. I like the sector. I'm going to buy it. If things go pretty high, they don't say, oh, I'm just going to sell out of it. I'm not going to short it because a lot less, fewer people short. What they do is, I'll hold on. I'll buy more. So the exhaustion levels, the readings that we see on the downside when they are buyable, or at least they are signaling that things are really getting out of hand to the downside, are much more effective from what we've seen in terms of going in and buying than when we see these exhaustion levels on the upside. Now, sometimes they play out pretty well, but I'll tell you where we are now. Where we are now is a plus six. Now, we go from a plus seven to a minus seven. Very rarely do we see a plus six with a cluster formation of other fives and sixes in a multi-day process. As a matter of fact, the last time we saw this particular exhaustion level reading was back in July of 2011. And right after that, within days, the market came down, I think, probably close to 15% in the next few weeks, actually the next 4 weeks. Now, I'm not suggesting that's going to happen here, but what I want to tell you is that we are really at a point that there has been a tremendous amount of buying and short squeezes that have gone on, and people are getting rather complacent in terms of the upside. Now, with that, when you look at that, you have to say, well, maybe it's time to consider hedging a portfolio, taking some off the table, maybe not. Because like I said, it could be the start of a continuation pattern as well. A lot of times we've seen where you have fours and fives and these cluster formations, it is a sign of a continuation pattern. There may be a drop for a couple of days. But remember what happens then. This is the difference between a bottom and a top. When you get to a top level, what happens is when it drops down, a lot of people are like, whoa, I didn't get into that. I should have been in that rally before, but I'm going to buy now. So they buy the dip that comes right away. So therefore, a lot of times, whereas if you have a bottom, people buy in, shorts are squeezed, and then it creates a bit of a snowball effect on the overall markets, and you have a lot more buyers come in a bit of a frenzy. Now, we saw probably the last oversold reading back in the third quarter of 2015, and you did see what happened in the final quarter of 2015, a massive rally that ensued for the next 3 months and then obviously rolled over into the next quarter. But what's interesting to note is that, you know, you do have these things that happen every once in a while, and again, they're rare. We're not looking for a daily situation here. We're looking really to find where are those incredibly overdone levels where sentiment is so stretched, where you see these kind of exhaustion levels that may be something that you could do with them for your portfolio. And again, that's what we just saw. This happened. So market down on March 4th, Friday, is when we saw this reading come to alive, and we'll see what happens moving forward. Again, I'm not suggesting to selling out. Be aware that we are at an exhaustion point from every indication that we see right now, and something that we see that could show a potential for a drawback over the next several days. Now, whether or not the fundamentals are, you know, going to really support what's going on right now, whether or not we do see that there is the continuation of oil moving higher and the squeeze happening, or if this is just kind of into the end of the week, into the weekly options expiration, had it pinned certain levels, we'll have to see. But bottom line is that we are at that level right now, so just keep an eye on the markets. With that, we're going to end the show. Again, you can find all the information on what we're talking about today on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Follow me on Twitter, Andrew Horowitz. Ask me any question you want through email, Andrew Horowitz. You can simply email askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Hope you have a great week. I'll see you again next week with some great guests. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.